For what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S., Kurdish, and Arab fighters claim to have controlled about half the besieged Islamic State-held stronghold of Manbij in northern Syria near the Turkish border. Meanwhile, in Aleppo, rebel fighters launched what they described as a major assault on the government-held southwestern sector. Ohio State University regional analyst Alam Payen was asked if the rebel attack is an act of desperation.
They're not very close to being dismantled, but whenever there is a pressure building on them, so they are going to resort to many other kinds of terrorism. They are pressured right now.
In the Syrian capital Sunday, the UN Deputy Special Envoy Ramzi E. Ramzi held talks with Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim on a third attempt at political transition talks with the opposition in Geneva.
I explained to the minister how we intend to proceed, and we discussed how to render this process of political transition, which has already been endorsed by the Security Council.
He said they want the talks to be credible. Embattled South African President Jacob Zuma, whose ruling African National Congress Party has been rocked by allegations of corruption and a lackluster economy Sunday, appealed to supporters to vote in Wednesday's municipal election.
The ANC wants an end to all forms of corruption and will diligently pursue all those who are corrupt.
The ANC controls most of the country's nearly 300 municipal governments. Mr. Zuma stressed his party's anti-apartheid history and the legacy of the late President Nelson Mandela. Polling suggests the ANC control of the local governments in Port Elizabeth, Pretoria, and Johannesburg could be in jeopardy. This is VOA News. Turkey's government dismissed hundreds of the members of the armed forces as part of an ongoing crackdown in the wake of the failed July 15th coup. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who has been posted to Turkey, said the coup attempt was a very serious threat to the democratically elected government.
This was a coup against a democratically elected government and president that was extraordinarily violent. I've lived through several coups and quasi-coups in Turkey. Nobody has seen anything like this.
Tens of thousands of Turks have now lost their jobs, been detained, suspended, questioned, and investigated for their alleged connection or support of Fethullah Gulen, a Muslim cleric who lives in the U.S. in exile. Mr. Erdogan has blamed him for being behind the coup attempt. Gulen has denied any connection to the upheaval. Iraqi officials say militants believed to be affiliated with the Islamic State Sunday attacked an oil pumping station and gas compressor station, killing at least five workers, sparking a major fire. Both assaults took place inside Kurdish-controlled areas of Kirkuk province. Yemen's internationally recognized government has agreed to extend UN-sponsored peace talks with Houthi rebels in Kuwait for another week. Amid reports, the government is about to leave those talks. The decision by President Abdrabo Mansour Hadi followed proposals by the UN envoy Ould Sheikh Ahmed for rebels to pull out of cities, including the capital Sana'a, hand over weapons they've taken from army depots within 45 days. The rebels have reportedly rejected this as a non-starter. At least six people were killed in the Somali capital Mogadishu Sunday when militants set off two car bombs outside a police headquarters. Authorities say all seven attackers were killed. The Islamist insurgency Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. A week ago, 13 people were killed in two car bomb blasts at the gate of the African Union's main peacekeeping base. Pope Francis ended his five-day trip to Poland Sunday with a large outdoor mass attended by hundreds of thousands, capping a week-long World Youth Day celebration. He urged the audience in Krakow, Poland, to believe in a new humanity that does not use borders as roadblocks and rejects hatred for each other. Muslims attended a Catholic mass in places of worship across France and Italy Sunday in a show of solidarity days after the jihadist murder of a Catholic priest in northwestern France.
C'est sûr que c'est un geste qui est un peu nouveau.
Monsignor Denis Jachier called it a new gesture and a good sign of relations between Catholics and Muslims. They joined about 2,000 people in the 11th century Gothic cathedral in the northern French city Rouen near the Normandy town where two teenagers slit the throat of an 85-year-old priest and took others hostage before being shot dead by police. Voters in Tokyo Sunday elected the city's first woman governor, who promised her new era of clean politics after two of her predecessors quit over money scandals. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Monday, the first day of August, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Joseph Kabila's government responds to an opposition ultimatum on elections.
It is not to Tshisekedi to designate who must organize the elections. These have been done already within the Constitution. We are under the rule of law. We are not under the rule of somebody called Tshisekedi.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. A supporter of former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar says President Salva Kiir has undermined the peace process. Burundi's central bank has run out of foreign currency. And is South Africa's ruling African National Congress in trouble for Wednesday's municipal election?
The opinion poll indicates that the ANC will have an uphill battle to hold on to three big metros in this country, namely Port Elizabeth or Pretoria, which is called Tshwane, and Johannesburg.
Sheila Kamara is a member of the Opposition Democratic Alliance Party of South Africa. Cameroon encourages female emancipation by saluting women stone breakers, and Ivorian chocolate makers promote locally made chocolate. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for the Democratic Republic of Congo's President Joseph Kabila says opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi is either ignorant or irresponsible for calling on Mr. Kabila to hold elections and step down by December 20th this year. Addressing his supporters in Kinshasa on Sunday, Tshisekedi reportedly said it would be high treason if Mr. Kabila did not launch the electoral process by September this year. But Information Minister Lambert Mende says it is the Electoral Commission that is in charge of organizing elections, not President Kabila. He said the Electoral Commission has already announced it cannot hold elections before the end of this year because the electoral census has started and is expected to continue for the next 10 months.
Those are, I think, not ignorance, but irresponsibility, because President Kabila is not in charge of organizing elections. According to Congolese law, it is to the Electoral Commission to organize elections. And the Electoral Commission has already announced that there is no way to organize elections before the end of this year, because the electoral census have started and will not end before at least 10 months. Mr. Tshisekedi is aware of that. And we are very surprised to hear a leader in his position saying things that he knows that will not happen.
The Electoral Commission you mentioned is supposed to meet or convene on, I think, it's September 19th. And Tshisekedi is saying from that time on, President Kabila has 3 months to organize the election.
It is not to Tshisekedi to designate who must organize the elections. These have been done already within the Constitution. We are under the rule of law. We are not under the rule of somebody called Tshisekedi. This country belongs to every Congolese. So we have organized ourselves under a constitution that gives to the Electoral Commission only the power to organize elections.
The opposition say that this is an attempt for President Kabila to continue in power.
They might think that this is an attempt, but we think that the Constitutional Court have already said that if there is no elections organized within that period, as the Constitution says, the incumbent president must remain in office until the elections are organized.
Minister, tell me, what is the purpose of the dialogue, the national dialogue that your government is advocating?
The purpose of the dialogue the President Kabila has called was to organize the situation after that delay will pass. That is why we say that a consensus is very necessary, so as we have an electoral process, a peaceful electoral process. And we have had already the approval of the majority of people of this country, and we are backed by the international community.
You said you have the backing of the international community. I guess that includes the African Union. I spoke last week with Mr. Fayulu of the opposition. He says that the opposition cannot participate in the dialogue because the facilitator, Mr. Idem Kojo, the former prime minister of Togo, is biased.
You are talking of this Fayulu, who is speaking on behalf of two members of parliament out of 500. My dear, let's be serious. We are talking of a country with 70 million people and with 500 members of parliament. And you are talking of somebody talking on behalf of two members of parliament. This is really something that is not significant at all.
Lambert Mendes, Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. A member of South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance Party says President Jacob Zuma's rhetoric ahead of Wednesday's municipal elections is a sign of desperation that the once mighty African National Congress may be losing grounds to the opposition in terms of favorability. Mr. Zuma on Sunday admonished South Africans to vote for the ANC so that the party will continue to improve their lives. The ANC controls majority of the country's 278 municipalities, but a new opinion poll shows the ANC is threatened in Pretoria, Johannesburg, and Port Elizabeth. Sheila Kamara, a former South African ambassador and a member of the Democratic Alliance Party, says this time around, many South Africans will not listen to President Jacob Zuma because they feel their lives have not been improved under years of ANC rule.
The statistics and the opinion polls indicate that the ANC will have an uphill battle to hold on to three big metros in this country, namely Port Elizabeth, it's called Nelson Mandela Bay, or Pretoria, which is called Tshwane, and Johannesburg, those three metros, where the Democratic Alliance is polling ahead of the ANC in two of them and level pegging in Johannesburg with the ANC. So it's a measure of the ANC's desperation, I think, that President Zuma is using all sorts of really quite peculiar bits of rhetoric to urge people to vote for the ANC, like saying yesterday, I think, that the ancestors would come back to haunt everybody if they didn't vote for the ANC. He's also using a number of racist remarks in his urging for DA support.
The president says to the people of South Africa that they should vote for the ANC because the ANC wants to continue improving the lives of the people.
Well, the reason why they're not going to heed his call is that a majority of people that he's appealing to feel that their lives haven't been improved at all. And the only big city where one can say without contradiction, you know, things have improved greatly and the only province lives have improved greatly is the Western Cape and Cape Town, which is controlled by the opposition Democratic Alliance.
What do you see as your party's chances going into the next election? Do you think you stand a chance?
Well, it very much depends on what will happen on the 3rd of August in this municipal election. And, I mean, at the moment, it's looking pretty good for the Democratic Alliance and the other opposition parties. And there's a serious chance that power can be wrested away from the ANC in at least two of those metros, possibly or even probably in a coalition between opposition parties.
President Zuma, I think he has 45 days to pay almost $500,000, funds that he used to upgrade his private residence. What do you make of that?
Well, yes, the Constitutional Court, our highest court, has decreed that this should happen. And in the Sunday papers, Mr. Zuma was quoted as saying that he's going to apply for a home loan and refinance his mortgage in that way. Because don't forget, he had 246 million rands worth of upgrades. So the value of his residence was greatly enhanced by all this corruption and crookery. So it will probably be quite easy for him to get an extended mortgage to pay this amount.
Sheila Kamara is a member of the opposition Democratic Alliance Party of South Africa. She was speaking with me from Pretoria. Today is Monday, August 1st, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Burundi's central bank has announced that it has run short of foreign reserves after a drastic depreciation of the local currency. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
For more than a year now, since the political crisis began in Burundi after the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza announced his decision to run for another term in the office, Burundi's local currency have depreciated against the foreign currencies, and United States dollars in particular. The central bank has struggled to control the rate of the foreign currencies. Within less than 3 weeks, the United States dollars rose drastically to more than 60% in the forex bureaus. Odas Niyonzima is the Burundi Central Bank Director of Research and Statistics.
Fluctuation is a permanent problem because of the decrease in the reserves. And the problem is common to many countries, but it was amplified in Burundi because of the crisis and the donors who frozen their transfers to Burundi. So that's why the central bank has to take measures to maintain the exchange rate stability.
The measures taken by the central bank to maintain the exchange rate stability was to impose its rates to the forex bureaus in the country. The Burundi government said there was kind of speculation that had led to the fluctuation of the exchange market. However, economic analysts have warned that the Burundi government's measure could only worsen the situation. Richard Ndereyahaga is an economic researcher and a lecturer at the University of Burundi.
If people are looking for dollars, the best way to solve that problem is to provide with some amount of dollars. Does the central bank have enough foreign currency? If they say you're not providing the foreign currencies to the forex, but we ask you forex to keep the same price, is it possible? The only result as an economist, and expect it, want it or not, it will happen. It will result in development and very high price at a real back market of forex.
According to the Burundi Central Bank, the average inflation since January this year was 3%. However, it accused the parallel market of creating the speculations that has led to the local currency to depreciate. Small business people have started feeling the impact of the fluctuating dollar. Ramadan Sengiyumva is a businessman in Bujumbura.
Leo tuko na zile vitu tuko nazo kwa stock, lakini kesho tukifika wakati wa kwenda kununua vitu
vingine. Ramadan says that today there is still some goods in the stock. He says he is worried about tomorrow when they will need foreign currency to import some goods, which may result to increase of the commodity prices. The shortage of foreign reserves in central bank comes after the United States and European Union suspended direct financial support to the Burundian government, including the budget support. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition says President Salva Kiir has undermined the peace process by replacing first Vice President Riek Machar with one-time rebel chief negotiator Taban Deng-Gai. This comes as South Sudan government sources tell VOA that President Kiir and his new first vice president are forging ahead with the implementation of last August's peace agreement. Myong Kwon is the UN representative of the SPLM in opposition. He says the agreement cannot be fully implemented without Riek Machar, who is one of the signatories.
If you're asking me that, do we still have peace agreement? Well, you must be asking Salva Kiir Mayardit, because the peace agreement says you cannot change anybody when the chairman of the party or the chairman of the peace partner is still alive.
What we know is that President Salva Kiir and the new first vice president, Taban Deng, are going ahead with what they call the implementation of the peace agreement. They have organized transitional national legislative assembly, civil servants, commissions, and committees in parliament and all that, as well as the states. So they are going ahead without Dr. Riek Machar.
Yes, and if they are going ahead, they are going ahead because it is actually IO within the government. Why? Because this partial part is still people who are being formed and supported by Salva Kiir Mayardit to implement the peace agreement their way. Don't forget that the peace agreement was signed between the two partners, and they call themselves partners in peace agreement. One is the IO, the other one is the IG. The other one is led by Salva, the other one is led by Riek Machar. So when they knew that they cannot implement the peace agreement according to what was signed, they decided to assassinate Dr. Riek Machar and place someone that is pro them so that they will implement peace thinking and fooling the world that they are implementing a peace agreement when they are not actually doing anything.
You say they tried to assassinate Dr. Riek Machar. I did speak with Ezekiel Gatkuov, and he told me that, in fact, President Salva Kiir, during the incident in July, President Salva Kiir was the one who protected everyone, protected even Riek Machar, protected all of them from being hurt.
James, if Salva Kiir protected Riek Machar in the State House, why would his forces on Sunday morning went and attacked Dr. Riek Machar? It is not true that he actually protected Riek Machar. It was Riek Machar's bodyguard that fought vigorously and refused to let Riek Machar being killed by them. They attacked him. That is a clear sign that they have violated the peace agreement and they have attacked the peace partner. It's no longer the peace partner. It is now the war.
What do you make of the statement by the United States saying that those who commit war crimes in South Sudan will be made to pay for their crimes?
Well, I don't know what the UN is talking about, when crimes were made. Is it the one that were just made as we speak now, or the one that were made 2 years ago, or the one that was made when? The reason we went to Juba with only 1,370 armed soldiers was to respect the peace agreement. And when Salva Kiir decided to destroy this peace agreement, he tried to kill Riek Machar first so that he can take over and then change everything and do it his way. So now if the world is saying that they are going to take those who have committed crimes, I have no problems, because Salva Kiir and his group have been killing innocent people since. And it is only this agreement that we're going to save people. So if they are talking about taking people who have committed crimes, I have no problem. We are ready. Whoever they have names on our side, they will be going and have right to explain themselves. But I'm very sure that Salva Kiir has a lot to say about this.
Myung Kwan is the UN representative of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. He was speaking with me from New York. The 54th observance of the day honoring the African woman who, in spite of several challenges, struggles to take care of her family, was observed on Sunday, July 31st. Ahead of the observance, reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka met 8 uneducated women in the northern Cameroonian town of Marua who specialize in cracking stones at a quarry to raise money to fund their children's education.
Thirty-four-year-old Janabu Abo understands and speaks only Fulfulde, a language widely spoken in northern Cameroon. She says she was the first lady to work in a quarry on the outskirts of Marua 8 years ago. And the men openly protested her participation in what was then a male-only activity. Janabu says she first started working as carrier of gravel, but today she now excavates and cracks stones. 28-year-old Habiba Ajara is another of the 8 women who have joined the stone-cracking business. She says 5 years after she got married, her husband became paralyzed.
Bon, j'ai fait cette métier, ça fait presque un an. Et bon, j'ai fait cette métier parce que mon mari n'a pas de travail. On a des enfants devant nous.
She says she started cracking stones 1 year ago because her unemployed husband was unable to send their children to school, feed them, buy dresses for them, and take care of the family. She says she makes up to $1 each day from the gravel she prepares and sells. The oldest female stone cracker here is 43-year-old Dauda Baba. She says stone cracking is the only job she was introduced to after she lost her first husband and all of her properties were seized by his family. She says she was poor and noticed that she could make money from the excavation of stones just as the other women who were there before her. She says her main preoccupations are feeding and education. Abena Ondua, Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment, encourages efforts that she says make women independent instead of always relying on their husbands.
They should not give up, and we will continue to work so that their conditions improve, and they must also make an effort to follow.
The Marwa female stone crackers are being used as an example of women who are meeting the challenges they encounter and contributing to development. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Ivory Coast is the world's top producer of cocoa, but hardly any of it is processed into chocolate in the country. Instead, the cocoa is sent abroad to chocolate makers in Europe and elsewhere. This is a general problem throughout Africa, with massive exports of raw materials but few finished goods. As Emily Yop reports from Abidjan, several Ivorian entrepreneurs are working to change that formula, 100% Ivorian chocolate bar at a time.
The Ivorian flag proudly embroidered on her cook suit, chocolate maker Suzanne Cabani is putting the latest touches on a special selection of chocolates she made ahead of the upcoming Independence Day. This year, we are using mold shaped as a traditional mask, the national coat of arms, and the CFA franc, Cabani explains. Cabani is one of a few Ivory Coast chocolate makers and also one of the first ones. 10 years ago, Cabani wanted to prove that it was possible to make high-end chocolate in Ivory Coast from local product. But it was hard to convince Ivorians it could be done.
J'ai commencé à créer des nouveaux parfums qui se sont adaptés pour des saveurs ivoiriennes.
I started creating various flavors adapted to local taste to encourage the population to eat their own products, she says. Ginger, cashew nut, coconut. The products are locally sourced, and Cabani works with the providers to enhance the quality of their raw product, especially the cocoa beans. Customers of La Maison du Chocolat Ivoirien are mostly middle-class Ivorians and expats. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara has said he wants the country to process half its cocoa production by 2020 versus about 30% at the moment. Recent billboards were put up around Abidjan to encourage consumption of Ivorian chocolate. Young entrepreneurs like former banker Axel Emmanuel are also making chocolate, but learning the trade is not yet popular. Emmanuel says people falsely believe chocolate is complicated and expensive to make. Emmanuel says they wonder, why make something that doesn't interest people? Who will buy it? He said that they prefer to make cakes because they know they'll sell them. But his business is booming, and he recently launched a more affordable chocolate bar that he sells in the street and claims he didn't compromise on the quality. Good evening, madam. Chocolate made in Ivory Coast, 200 francs, says a vendor, toting a nice cooler and sporting a printed T-shirt. At 30 US cents, the 50 grams bar have been selling fast. At a nearby cafe, three men at a table sit in front of a pile of chocolate they just bought for the children. The price is very competitive. For that chocolate bar, 200 francs, it's very cheap, says the man. Emmanuel's next bet is to raise enough money via crowdfunding to attend the Salon du Chocolat in France and prove that Ivorian-made chocolate can rival chocolate made abroad. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan, Ivory Coast.
And that's it for this Monday, August 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with all of our engineers, I am James Botti in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.